You remember when banking used to be boring? Yeah, we do too. And you know what? So do the big banks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, 22 Feb. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Here we sit, 10 years after the American financial system basically imploded, and something kind of amazing has happened. New regulations were put in place, as you know, the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. Not, it is necessary to point out, without a whole lot of political back and forth on that. Rules and regulations were written pursuant to the Dodd-Frank law, again with a political back and forth. Republicans won Congress and the White House. The new president called Dodd-Frank a, quote, disaster and promised to, quote, do a big number on it, end oh, quote. And now that president's administration, the Treasury Department to be specific, says, yeah, it's okay with keeping a piece of Dodd-Frank that would let the government liquidate failing financial firms in times of crisis. It's become clear that the core pieces of Dodd-Frank aren't going anywhere. And you know what? Some of the big banks, they say that's all right. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Nearly 8 years after President Obama signed Dodd-Frank into law,
Dodd-Frank is here to stay.
Aaron Klein is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The divisive political rhetoric around Dodd-Frank hid the broad substantive agreement behind many of its core provisions.
He says at this point, it looks more likely that legislative changes to Dodd-Frank would be more tinkering than overhauling, though the Trump administration has been more aggressive in targeting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau created by Dodd-Frank. Peter Wallison with the American Enterprise Institute says Congress might also ease parts of the law that apply to smaller community banks.
And that's important and very useful if it can be done. And that's the kind of thing that the Democrats would be willing to support.
But one reason we may not be seeing more aggressive efforts to roll back Dodd-Frank is because the financial industry doesn't want that to happen. Last week, Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan said, quote, Dodd-Frank is fine. None of us are trying to touch it. Joshua Rosner is managing partner of research consultancy Graham Fisher & Company.
The cost of implementing Dodd-Frank were very expensive for all of the banks and investment banks. That said, they've largely gotten used to the requirements of and made their business adjustments and largely spent the money to implement the Dodd-Frank requirements.
And they don't want to turn back now. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Speaking of turning back, here with a truism, especially in this digital age, live by the celebrity endorsement, die by the celebrity change of heart. Shares of Snap, parent company of Snapchat, lost 6% today after super user Kylie Jenner went public with her discontent over the platform's latest update, which says, we are obliged to ask, what exactly about the robustness of that company's business model? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
One thing people loved about the old Snapchat, photos, videos, and posts from your friends were mixed with photos, videos, and posts from celebrities. Celebrities and friends now are separated. The company's taken so much flack over that change that Pivotal Research analyst Brian Weiser says the CEO talked about it last week.
People are saying that they feel like the celebrity's no longer my friend. And he says, yes, you're right. They're not your friend. Like, that's the point.
Reality TV star Kylie Jenner is apparently one of the people who doesn't like Snapchat's redesign. To her 24.5 million followers on Twitter, she wrote, so does anyone else not open Snapchat anymore? Not great PR, but is it actually a problem for Snap when a celebrity turns sour?
To put this much emphasis on Kylie Jenner, I think it's a little bit out of proportion.
James Chalkmock is an analyst with Moness Crespi Hart. Chalkmock says people aren't on Snapchat because of celebrities. Fundamentally, they're there because it's a fun and useful photo and messaging app with friends. The real problem with Kylie Jenner's tweets may be that she's a proxy for regular users, like 23-year-old Philadelphian Noelle Vaught.
You know, Snapchat was always kind of a fun, quick thing to do with friends, and now it's just, you know, things are changing.
Vaught says her problem, the new Snapchat makes it harder to connect with her friends, and it's user complaints like Vaught's that led one firm, Citigroup, to downgrade the company's stock this week. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, no downgrades at all. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whatever Congress and the White House might or might not be able to agree on about DACA and the broader immigration issue, things are already happening out in the real economy. A lot of younger undocumented immigrants, Dreamers specifically, people brought here as kids, are considering their options. And some are going back to where they were born, looking for opportunities they don't have here. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports on a group of those folks training to become software engineers.
The students here grew up all over the U.S. They're from Oregon,
California,
Texas,
Mandalay, Illinois,
North Carolina, Florida,
Bradenton, Sarasota,
Marco Castillo, Miriam Alvarez, and Eddie Barrañón. In the States, they would be considered dreamers, people who were brought to the U.S. as children without proper documents. But they returned to Mexico, and here in the capital city, they initially found similar jobs.
I was working in a contact center.
Customer will call.
I was actually working at the call center of AT&T.
Their work paid them less than $2 an hour. So when Eddie Barrañón, a 27-year-old from Illinois, heard there was a school paying returning dreamers to become software engineers, he thought it was too good to be true.
Nice camp, but I thought it was like a fake. Like, you know, I wasn't going to be true, or there was something iffy about it.
The truth is, this is a very unusual project. In Mexico, most public discourse about immigrants centers on those still living in the U.S. People here don't spend as much time talking about dreamers once they return to their country of birth.
But the reality is they're back into a foreign country that they've never been to.
Meet Marcela Torres. She's the mastermind behind this boot camp called Hola Code. She went to school for a while in the U.K. before coming back to Mexico. She says she and her co-founder started working on this project a year and a half ago.
We were given practically this gift from the United States, and I know it's horrible to say it in that way because I know they miss it and they call it home. But if Mexico really took the opportunity and used their potential, it could be endless.
The first 24 students at Hola Code are about halfway through their five-month program, which is modeled after a boot camp in San Francisco called Hack Reactor. They're getting funding from a Mexican foundation and an angel investor here. One of the students' challenges is changing the way they see Mexico. A local businessman, Eduardo Garcia, gave a talk at the school about precisely that.
The first few months that I was here, I was really depressed.
Garcia arrived in Mexico City 10 years ago after the third time he'd been deported. He says when people get here, many just want to go back.
You don't see this other Mexico on the rise, a Mexico that needs people like them. A Mexico that needs bilingual people, a Mexico that needs engineers.
Garcia got a job as a cook, which is what he'd done in Atlanta. He now owns three of Mexico City's trendiest restaurants with more than 100 employees.
There's a tremendous amount of opportunity.
Matin Tamizi is an entrepreneur based in San Francisco who's considering hiring from the Dreamer Coding School. He started a financial services company in Silicon Valley and is now looking to do the same in Mexico. He says he wants to hire people who understand Mexican and American cultures.
They essentially become the bridge between the way that we do business as an American company to our target customers, which is in the Mexican market.
This is a welcome prospect for Eddie Barrañón. He says he initially wanted to return to Illinois to be with his wife and two children, who are U.S. citizens. But now when he talks to his wife...
Like, every time I call my girl, I'm like, hey, I really don't want to go back. I'm like, I mean, we can live a life here. I'm like, we can do a lot of stuff. I mean, I have a lot of plans.
Barrañón eventually wants to start his own business. He says Mexico is a land of opportunity. It just takes time to see it. In Mexico City, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
The Rob Porter scandal at the White House and other scandals elsewhere, yes, but Porter in particular, have brought domestic violence back into the news. That means more awareness of nonprofits that offer services and sometimes shelter to victims. More victims are going to go looking for help, which is a good thing, and maybe more people will decide to donate. From Washington, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Tucked behind a building on a busy street in D.C. is My Sister's Place. It's one of the first nonprofits in the city for victims of domestic violence. And at the moment, the offices are crowded with supplies.
We've got diapers. Over here we have sheets. We have baby toys. Towels.
That's Valerie Graff, the interim executive director. Those supplies will go to the small women's shelter My Sister's Place operates. Like most organizations, this one is funded by a mix of local and federal dollars. And then, donations.
We've had an enormous outpouring of support in the last couple of months.
In fact, twice as many donations as past years, thanks in part to the Me Too movement. But as always, the need is greater than what they can provide. My Sister's Place can house 15 families, but it gets roughly 2,500 calls a year. Pamela Paziotopoulos is president of the Center for Domestic Policy Violence in Chicago. Paziotopoulos says a high-profile case, particularly when there are photos involved.
What it does do for a lot of victims that are out there, it gives permission and it gives confidence to victims to be able to come forward.
Paziotopoulos says while it's too early to know just how much all these recent cases will impact fundraising, her contacts at shelter say,
been a little bit easier this last month.
High-profile cases can also result in policy changes. Emily Martin is with the National Women's Law Center and says in some cases, the legislative groundwork is there, but progress has stalled.
But when the public is galvanized by an issue, that helps Congress act.
Martin points to one of the best-known examples, Nicole Brown Simpson.
The O.J. Simpson trial in the 1990s, which was a real moment of interest and attention around the problem of domestic violence, and was about the same time that the Violence Against Women Act actually passed Congress.
And the money that the Violence Against Women Act provides, that's the money that really matters. In Washington, D.C., I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's just more difficult to raise oyster larvae these days.
Trying to build a future for those baby oysters. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 164 today, 0.6%, finished at 24,962. I don't think I've ever said baby oysters on this program before. The NASDAQ off 8 points, about 0.1%, 7210. S&P 500 up 2 points. We'll call that flat, 2703. Energy companies among the biggest gainers today. Chesapeake Energy up 21% after it beat revenue and profit expectations. ExxonMobil gained 1.3%. Avis up 13.4% today after it beat sales expectations in the fourth quarter. And better yet, moved into the black. Hertz went along for the ride, gained 15.7%. Wendy's missed expectations on sales growth in its most recent quarter. Shares up 4% anyway because capitalism. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Federal Communications Commission's decision on net neutrality, specifically its repeal of rules designed to make sure all internet content is treated equally. That decision the FCC announced back in December. It is officially on the books today with its publication in the Federal Register, effective date April the 23rd. And now that that's happened, the lawsuits that opponents have been promising can finally be filed. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports one of the main legal strategies is going to rest on the idea of interstate commerce.
We all know you can't say on the radio.
That's a case where radio and television broadcasting is clearly committed just to the FCC to regulate.
Harold Feld of the nonprofit Public Knowledge says states can't make up their own rules here. New York can't go, well, we're a salty bunch. We're going to let our broadcasters get away with whatever they want to do. Conversely, Utah can't say,
well, we think hell and damn are too salty, so we're going to include those on the list of dirty words.
That's because radio and television cross state lines, so an authority larger than the state gets to override them. Now, broadband internet clearly crosses state lines, but weirdly enough, the FCC seemed to give up its authority to regulate broadband in recent legal language. State challengers are seizing on that language to say,
we don't believe the FCC has the power to override state laws on net neutrality.
That's Scott Wiener, a California state senator who's introduced a bill to preserve net neutrality there. His bill would also make neutrality a condition of doing business for internet providers that want all important state contracts. Former FCC enforcement chief Travis LeBlanc says that approach is the most bulletproof.
The government, whether it's federal or state, imposes numerous terms and conditions as a part of the procurement process.
States do this all the time, requiring in-state workers for state contracts or a certain minimum wage. If companies don't like it, LeBlanc says, they can take their workers elsewhere, but they can't really challenge it in court. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Seems like every time you turn around, or change the channel, I guess, is the better analogy, there's another rebooted series on TV. Will and Grace, Fuller House, Roseanne is coming back. Familiar names, and they are back because, well, that's why we've called Michael O'Connell. He's a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Michael, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Why are we having all these reboots right now?
Well, for one, not much else is working. The last year has seen a rather unexpected wave of rebooted 90s and even a little 80s sitcom television on the broadcast networks.
Yeah.
Roseanne's coming up next month. Will and Grace came on the air in the fall, and now we're getting Murphy Brown, and we may even be getting Mad About You.
Oh, seriously? I hadn't heard that, and I can't decide. Wow, I can't decide if I'm excited or dreading it.
I know, that one's an outlier, because the rest of these have been sort of prompted by current events, because all three of those shows touched on politics in America in a way that not many of their contemporaries did. And I think that's part of the impetus. But no, Mad About You, that's a real outlier.
Huh. Well, I guess we'll see how that one goes. Let me ask you this, though. Is it just a lack of creativity that's bringing all this old stuff back? I mean, we're told all the time, we're at peak TV, it's the best time to be doing television because, holy cow, there's all this opportunity.
I don't think it's a lack of creativity so much as it is a byproduct of the sheer abundance of programming and programmers right now. There's going to be over 500 scripted shows on one vehicle or another in the U.S. this year. And it's just so much easier for these shows to make an impact. People want to talk about them. We're talking about them right now. They sell themselves.
Yeah. But here's another point, right? That it's not quite twice as expensive, but it's expensive to produce these reboots because not only do you have to pay the production costs and the actors and actresses for the new model, you have to pay the person who created the old one as well.
Yes, and one thing that we've seen with this crop is that most of the original creators are involved. Will and Grace, this was prompted by Max Muchnick, one of the co-creators, bringing his cast together for a pro-HRC clip at the end of the 2016 election. Huh. And Roseanne followed right after Will and Grace. And Roseanne being the weird example because the creator of that show was ousted in the first 13 episodes, but he's still getting paid for this.
Right. So what's your gut then? We're going to see more of these, right? Because it's making money for Hollywood and the studios and everybody involved.
This is going to be a sort of natural ebb and flow, I think, for the next, I would say, decade, maybe. There's not going to be the abundance that there is right now. One of these is going to completely tank, and it's going to make everyone shy away from it.
Right.
So I think these are going to shine bright and brief. And subjects and series that lend themselves to a revival are going to pop back up on the radar, but I don't think that it's going to be the dominant narrative in television.
Without betraying my one-time crush on Helen Hunt, which I just betrayed, are Helen and Paul Reiser going to be involved in the new one of Mad About You?
Helen and Paul have been in talks with Sony. That's an interesting situation because no one is clamoring for that. That anyone was sitting around waiting for Murphy Brown to come back. God bless her. If Mad About You comes back, I don't think it's going to come back on NBC. It would more likely show up on a Hulu or a Netflix, and I feel like that would be a one-off.
Huh. Michael O'Connell writes most recently about all these reboots for The Hollywood Reporter. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A story now about economic cause and effect in the form of oysters on the half shell. They've always been symbols of the culinary good life oysters have. Exotic, primal, maybe even a little bit naughty, if you believe that old wives' tale. But over the past decade or so, getting them on your plate has become more challenging. Carbon emissions and global warming are changing the oceans in ways that baby oysters can't handle. So scientists and shellfish farmers are looking for a fix. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jess Burns explains.
The tide flat on Hood Canal is only exposed for a few hours a day. So tide is money at Baywater Shellfish Farm west of Seattle. Manager Caleb Davis flips and sorts through bags of shellfish.
This is a good-looking oyster for you, a nice deep cup. Ideally, this will be sitting on a platter in a restaurant ASAP.
Caleb's father, Joth Davis, founded Baywater back in the 90s. They farm clams, gooey duck, and oysters. His business is part of the Pacific Northwest's $200 million shellfish industry. But the industry is in trouble.
It's just more difficult to raise oyster larvae these days.
That's because ocean chemistry is changing. The ocean absorbs more than a quarter of the carbon dioxide we pump into the air. And all that carbon is making seawater more acidic and making it more and more difficult for oysters to grow. But what if there was a way to pull some of that carbon out of the water? Brian Allen is up to his elbows in the cold black water of Hood Canal. The Puget Sound Restoration Fund researcher is hanging over the side of a small boat trying to pull in a tangle of ropes.
Oh, yeah, Daddy.
Below the surface, there's an unseen garden of yellow kelp growing on 60-foot lines. Allen untangles one and hooks it onto a winch. He starts cranking the kelp to the surface, marveling at the plant he pulls in.
I use the term plant loosely.
Got it.
They are not plants. They're protists related to slime molds and amoebas.
But like trees and bushes, kelp makes energy through photosynthesis. Carbon dioxide in, oxygen out. And that's why this project could be important in combating ocean acidification. Remember, that's caused when there's too much carbon in the water. Allen's colleague, Betsy Peabody, helped organize this study to see just how much carbon the kelp can take up or sequester.
So you could create, in theory, a kind of seaweed filter, you know, curtain around where you're growing shellfish, so that as water is circulating through that system, seaweed is pulling CO2 out of the water.
Baywater Shellfish's Joth Davis is working with the scientists on the kelp project. He sees a dual economic potential in growing kelp and oysters together.
I'm looking at interspersing shellfish in cages hanging below buoys, and then every other line would be kelp. Between the two of them, we'll be able to harvest both kelp for food and shellfish.
The project is now entering its second year. Davis says the plan is to move beyond the science and try harvesting the kelp in late spring. Even though harnessing the carbon-sucking powers of kelp and other aquatic plants like seagrass is showing promise for the shellfish industry, there's only so much the plants can do. And Davis says ocean conditions are going to get worse as we continue pumping carbon into the atmosphere.
I think in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, there will be some very serious issues.
And it won't just be the shellfish industry that suffers. These changes in ocean chemistry could soon become problems for crab, shrimp, and even salmon. On the Hood Canal in Washington, I'm Jess Burns for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the confession that I thought Black Panther was kind of amazing. Some people, though, maybe not so much.
Thank you for calling the Village of Wakanda. If you know your party's extension, please.
Read in the Hollywood Reporter today that the town of Wakanda, Illinois, population 14,000 or so, has been getting calls and emails asking for vibranium and whether the high school would change its mascot from a bulldog to a Black Panther. It won't, but cool, huh? And we are out of here. Dow Industrial's up 164 today, about 0.6%. NASDAQ down 8, about 0.1%. S&P 500, we'll call it flat. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.